The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Bob Johansson. Bob has authored and co-authored 8 books, including The Reciprocity Advantage and Get There Early, Sensing the Future to Compete in the Present. He is a highly regarded keynote speaker and consultant, having worked with such companies as Kellogg's, Disney, Intel, and McDonald's. He's a distinguished fellow at the Institute for the Future, an organization that he started working with in 1973. He has many degrees and accomplishments, including a PhD in sociology of religion from Northwestern University. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Happy to be here.
So we're going to get to your work, but in your book, and I believe it was in Get There Early, you quoted Voltaire, and this quote has stuck with me since I read it a couple of weeks ago. And the quote is, "Doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is absurd." That feels terribly apt for the times we live in right now.
Yes, definitely. I think the times we live in now require clarity, mm-hmm. but they punish certainty. So we're in a period that the military folks call the VUCA world, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And certainly it's gotten more so in the last couple of weeks. So in a period like that, the lesson from the VUCA world is you want to be very clear where you're going, but very flexible how you get there. So the challenge for leaders is to kind of hone up and amp up your clarity, but to be very careful and to moderate your certainty, because certainty becomes very brittle in a VUCA world.
Oh, well, I mean, truer words have never been spoken. And I mean, because I think what you're seeing right now is – you know, people are definitely looking at where they're going, but they are doing so with a level of certainty that, as this quote points out, is absolutely absurd. I'm talking left and right. I'm talking everyone. It is lines drawn in the sand. And I mean, I can't even imagine what the aftermath of these Thanksgiving family dinners is going to be. Someone's going to have to compile a book on how this Thanksgiving went with regard to, you know, people just don't want to give in.
Yeah, it's really a challenge. And, you know, I guess my take on it, again, I'm a 10-year forecaster, so I kind of live my life 10 years ahead and have been doing so for the last 30 years or so. So I'm not an expert in the present. Yeah. But my take on the present is that the VUCA world, the uncertainty all around us, is just too much for a lot of people. So they become ripe for simple or more dangerously simplistic solutions to problems that actually can't be solved. They're more like dilemmas. And we have to figure out how to live with those uncertainties. And for a lot of people, it's just too much. They can't really deal with it. So the fallback position is go for a simple solution. And there are always politicians and religious leaders who have one. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people who are ripe for that right now. The challenge is it gets very dangerous because you really can't describe what's going on with certainty, and it requires flexibility. And I do think the military is ahead of most of us in coping with it, and they have developed tools. You know, in the military now, I started working with military folks after 9/11, mostly at the graduate school level, particularly at the Army War College. And their big lesson is that You know, what works in this kind of world is what they call commander's intent, which again goes back to what I call clarity. You want to be very clear about direction, but very flexible about execution. This really is not a period where hierarchy works well. You need hierarchy with regard to direction, but you need extreme flexibility with regard to execution.
Right. And what you brought up earlier, I think, is really key, because you do write about this and get there early. You talk about the difference between problems and dilemmas, and that an important issue for people to understand is that many leaders were trained in problem solving. And I think I quote you when you say the emerging world needs a skill set based in dealing with dilemmas. What's the difference between the problems and the dilemmas?
Well, the simple difference is a dilemma is a problem you can't solve. Mm-hmm. It won't go away, and you have to work with it anyway. So if you're not sure if it's a problem or a dilemma, you should view it as a dilemma. Because if it turns out to be a problem, you just solve it and you get extra credit.
Right.
But if you take a problem or if you take a dilemma and you call it a problem, and you don't solve it, then everybody's disappointed. To me, I think that's a lot of the reason why President Obama got in so much trouble around Obamacare, is that healthcare is a dilemma. You know, healthcare in the United States is not a solvable problem.
Right.
And yet you can improve it. But the language that the Obama people chose to use to describe it was problem solver language. And it's just not a problem you can solve. So what that does is set expectations unrealistically high. And it is true, you know, most of today's leaders were trained in problem solving. There will still be plenty of problems we have to solve, but the leaders don't get to solve them anymore. Those are solved by people who work for them. The leaders deal with pretty much all dilemmas now, from mid-level on up. Certainly top leaders are dealing with nothing but dilemmas. And, you know, where I learned to deal with dilemmas was in divinity school.
So,
you know, religions, at least those that don't have kind of high demand theologies, most religions at least deal with dilemmas and deal with uncertainty through different structures. The more rigid and fundamentalist the religion, the less able they are to deal with dilemmas. But most of the world's religions have a lot of flex built into the theology. You know, faith always includes questioning. And you know, I think that's what we all need, is that ability to deal with dilemmas and come out ahead anyway.
Right. And what also makes sense then is when you look at certainly all the major religions are so story oriented in terms of delivering. And you say that dilemmas must be understood through stories and experiences. And I think the story respects the fluidity, the fact that there probably isn't a solution, but at least it gives us a way to sort of, you know, run through the morass, I guess.
That's right. I think story-based religions have a big advantage in a time like this because there's more flex built into the story. Those that are governed by absolute shalls, you know, absolute shalls get you in a lot of trouble in the VUCA world. The good thing about absolute shalls and absolutist religions is they kind of take away the ambiguity and the uncertainty and, you know, promise you deliverance either in this life or next. The bad news is that they're just very brittle, and they're not able to have much flex. So the story-based religions do better. The rules-based religions get more isolated and in some cases more dangerous.
Yeah. And it shouldn't be a surprise then that, you know, you hear all the marketers in the world talk about, you know, effective storytelling. And I 3/4 of the guests that we have on the show, and a lot of them are business leaders or they're in tech, they're all English majors. They recognized at a certain point that no matter what they were going to apply their skill in, the idea of understanding story, character, and expression and communication was going to be vital if they were going to really get anything done. Not necessarily even solved, but done.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's one of the really hopeful signs, is that we are now understanding the importance of stories. And you know, one of my friends is a master storyteller who worked on this project that Defense Department funded on the neuroscience of storytelling. And this was funded by Defense Department. It was all based on the fact that in Afghanistan, our stories, the U.S. stories, weren't working as well as the Taliban stories. And what this work proved conclusively was that our brains are wired for stories. And if we don't hear stories, we make them up.
Right.
So, you know, that's not really... You know, it's not really a completely new concept. What's new is we now have data. We now have fMRI data that shows how our brains are just, we all have this personal neural story net that we tell ourselves. And, you know, as a futurist, what I realized right away is that before I talk to anybody, they all have their own hindsight and their own neural story net that they're telling themselves. And if I can't break into their story, I'm dead. You know, I can't go anywhere. But it is hopeful to me that there's more people now understanding the importance of story. And what I can do is to give them the future as a context for storytelling. And it's really interesting to me. I find that the further you go out into the future, the easier it is for people to open up and to kind of open their personal neuro story net and to get away from the polarities of the present. So, you know, what I find is the future gets increasingly valuable as a way of opening people up, but then you've got to pull the thread from foresight to insight to action to make it practical.
That's really interesting. You know, we talk a lot because at Second City, of course, our expertise is improvisation, and there is this, you know, intense requirement to be present and wholly present. But that's not the only thing, right? And, because what you're doing as well when you're improvising is a bit of mental modeling for where the future can be. You just can't live in the future. So what it requires you to do is essentially it's the Danny Kahneman stuff of, you know, your system one and system
yeah.
two. They're both working. And I think that, you know, we're terribly used to and more comfortable with the idea that things are more binary or more single, and it gets more complicated when you realize that it's always two things.
Yeah, and it, you know, I'm kind of a mutant, I guess, in terms of improv logic, in that I'm really focused 10 years ahead, and I'm not that interested in the present except as it reveals signals about the future. On the other hand, I'm very present in the future. So in other words, given that future context and the fact that I live my life 10 years ahead, I'm really present in that future that hasn't happened yet. So there's a kind of dilemma quality to it, and I'll give you one specific example.
Yeah.
We did a forecast for Syngenta on the future of food security, and what we found was that with food security, people were so polarized in the present, particularly in Western Europe and particularly about GMO foods, that at 10 years out, nobody could talk to each other. All they could do is kind of yell at each other and have a polarized knocking of heads. And they're very committed people who are very sincere in their beliefs. But they truly believe within the immediate time horizon that GMO foods is a yes or no choice. Now, so we chose, instead of doing a 10-year forecast, we chose to go out 30 years and then said, imagine yourself present 30 years from now. So it's applying, you know, Second City logic about being present,
right,
but it's applying it in a futures context. So when we write scenarios, we write them in present tense 30 years ahead.
Right.
And what we found was when you go 30 years out, it's obvious that GMO foods and food chemistry is not a yes-no choice. It's a spectrum of choices. And there's good GMO and there's bad GMO. And 30 years out, that's obvious. So you can have a foresight, inside action conversation. But in this case, anyway, 10 years out wasn't enough. We had to go 30 years out to actually start the conversation.
Yeah, and again, in a manner of speaking, that shouldn't be surprising. I was talking to a scholar at an event recently And we were discussing the fact that for the first time really in the history of improvisation as an art form, it's starting to get studied and there's majors in it and that sort of thing. And he goes, when did improv start? And I go, well, like mid-50s. He goes, well, you know, cinematic arts wasn't taught in colleges until 20 years ago. And you realize, oh, yeah, the timeline on these things, sometimes, you know, it's just too soon. I'm curious if you've at all touched any of the work that I've been hearing a lot about, you know, what's going to happen with the aging population and that we're really not prepared to take care of basically our elderly. And that's coming very quickly. That's a matter of like 5, 6, 7 years, I think.
Yeah, and that's kind of a sad one because we distinguish here between a trend and a disruption. Mm-hmm. And a trend is a pattern of change you can extrapolate from with confidence. A disruption is a break in the patterns of change. And demography, and especially the aging population, that's a trend. It's just obvious, and yet we're not really dealing with it. We are doing projects here. We did a game, a massive online multiplayer game on the future of caregiving.
Right.
That was for United Cerebral Palsy, but it applied to all kinds of caregivers, including caring for people who are older. And then we're also doing a study right now on the future of caregiving that is, I don't know who that's funded by. I can't remember who's sponsoring. I'm one of the participants, but I'm not the lead on it. Mm-hmm. But I think that's an obvious area. There's really interesting things going on in Japan about that, and they are facing up to it. And interestingly, they're way ahead of any other country on with the use of robots for elderly caregiving. And one of the reasons is they're so reluctant to bring in immigrant populations that you know, they'd almost rather deal with a robot than an immigrant. And, you know, that's obviously a position that's somewhat unfortunate, but it's tended to accelerate. You know, their cultural homogeneity has made them more open to tech, not solutions, but at least ways of managing. And I'm actually quite optimistic about caregiving robots, although you need more than them.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay, I do want to talk about the reciprocity advantage, because I really enjoyed that book. And one of the things I enjoyed most about it is that you're basically asserting that we need to reorient the way we've traditionally conceived of business and philanthropy. And you write that, quote, advantage is basic to business, reciprocity is basic to life. And then also you write, reciprocity lives in the space between transactions and philanthropy. And I'm fascinated about that space between.
Right. And let's just to keep current, let's link it to the concept of winning.
Okay.
You know, what does it mean to be a winner in this world? And I think what's really clear if you look 10 years ahead in this world of distributed everything, I mean, one of our core forecasts is anything that can be distributed will be distributed. Mm-hmm. And in a world of distributed everything, reciprocity becomes the currency of commerce. It isn't just buying and selling stuff, and it isn't just I win, you lose. It's looking for ways where you understand your own right of way, your own right to play, if you will, and you're willing to give away certain elements of your underused assets in the faith that you're going to get back even more in return. And it really moves into the non-zero-sum game world. And I don't know if you've seen the new movie that just came out this month called Arrival, but that's a really cool movie. Mm-hmm. And it's really all about reciprocity. I just saw it last week, and the reciprocity advantage is used in the McComb School of Business at University of Texas. And I got a call from one of their professors the day the movie came out and said, oh, my students love this new movie, and they all say it's about reciprocity advantage. And I saw the movie, and I think they're right. Because it really is how it took an alien view to identify the things we all had in common around the world. And they introduced essentially a language of reciprocity that got people thinking about non-zero-sum games.
Mm-hmm. I think also your example of TED Talks is a terrific one, where really they created a global brand based on almost pure reciprocity, right?
Exactly. And it's a nonprofit, but it's a very profitable nonprofit.
Right. We gave a talk at Microsoft last week, and after the event, a woman came up to me and she said, I'd known about this yes and idea, you know, in improvisation for some time, but I think I was too focused on the yes part. And you've got me thinking that the and might be the more crucial part. And that struck me because you write that the ancient wisdom of reciprocity will be reborn in a digitally enhanced world of and.
That's right. It's really all about and. And, you know, what we say is that the future is a future of and, not or. And it's really a both and future. But you still have to win. So that's why I really loved writing this book with Carl Rahn, who's, you know, he's kind of the ultimate business guy. And he was referred to at Procter & Gamble as the Clayton Christensen of Procter & Gamble. But he also had a job much harder than Clayton's in the sense that, you know, Clayton studies industries that have failed and does postmortems on them. What Carl's job was to create industries that didn't exist and have them succeed. So he was the guy behind Febreze and Mr. Clean Magic Eraser and Swiffer and products like that. But I think you have to, the way I'm thinking about it, you have to think about both the notion of reciprocity, which is kind of give to get logic, and the fact that to be sustainable, there's got to be a valid business model in there somewhere. And it's not only do you win, but others can win too. In fact, it's really a non-zero-sum game world, and that comes back to the winner. I think one of the questions about the new administration, and again, I'm not an expert in the present, but as a futurist, one of the questions I have is, you know, does the new president have a wide enough concept of winning, and is he open to win-win solutions as well as, you know, traditionally the concept of a winner implies that somebody else lost. Yeah. So if you're negotiating, you get your fair share and you screw the other guy. But in this kind of world we're moving into, that kind of logic gets you in a lot of trouble, too. But you've got to figure out win-win solutions, particularly on a global stage.
Right. And I enjoy, too, that you compare that with the thinking you have around transparency and the importance of that. And in particular, talking about brands who are not transparent are going to be made transparent, whether they like it or not.
Yeah.
And you write, forced transparency may well be unfair. What do you think is the value of transparency in this sort of reciprocity exchange?
Well, you know, at this stage, transparency mm-hmm. is going to be kind of part of the requirement to play. And companies that don't voluntarily do it are going to be forced into it. And the point we make in the book is that forced transparency often is inaccurate transparency. And then suddenly the company's on the defensive. So you're better off leading with that more transparent approach. But the challenge in this much more digital world is that transparency is kind of built in to the way we work together. It's much harder to hide things in that world. On the other hand, it still is possible to manipulate the story and have the story play out in different ways. So there's a kind of future of advertising question embedded in that. There's a future of the corporation embedded in that. You know, the new book I'm working on now is all about future leadership literacies. And beyond, you know, Leaders Make the Future has 10 future leadership skills. And I think those are the right skills. But what I've concluded over the last 6 years since that book came out is that we need literacies to wrap around the skills. And one of those literacies is the literacy of distributed leadership. You know, in a world where anything that can be distributed will be distributed, how can you lead when you're not there physically? Mm-hmm. And the challenge, and another leadership literacy that I'm exploring in the new book, is how to be better than being there. where I think a lot of our current technology is modeled on simulating face-to-face. Well, that's not good enough.
Right.
You know, face-to-face isn't good enough. We've got to figure out a way to be better than being there. And face-to-face is still important for things like orientation and trust building and renewal. But if you're physically separated, you've got to be transparent and engaging about the whole process.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you.
We'll see you next week on Getting the Yes And. Well, I've been working in a